Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded March 8th, 2023. While March 20th marks the 20th anniversary of America's second invasion of Iraq, despite the tens of millions of people across the globe coming into the streets to hold at bay the dogs of George Bush's generational war, Operation Iraqi Freedom's shock and awe, called Blitzkrieg in another era, was launched. We all know what happened and the failure of the people to stop the slaughter then and in Afghanistan in 2001 seemed to be the end of hope for the peace movement. But the flame for a world without war didn't die and has in fact recently been spotted flickering in the capitals of Europe, Canada, and even in Washington, D.C. Ken Stone is an executive member of both the Syria Support Movement International and Hamilton Coalition to Stop the Wars. Ken Stone in the first half. And far from fulfilling its mandate to first be an agent opposing war in the world, the United Nations' repeated failures in that seminal mission are now manifest in its endeavoring the opposite, the promotion of economic sanctions and military intervention. At least the recently released group of experts on human rights on Nicaragua's report leaves little else to conclude. Dan Kovalik is a lawyer, educator, labor, peace and justice activist, democracy defender, journalist, author, and filmmaker. His book titles include Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture, The Plot 2 series on American efforts to undermine the governments and economies of Iran, Venezuela, Russia, and the world generally, and No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interests. His latest is the recently released Nicaragua, A History of U.S. Intervention and Resistance. Dan Kovalik and the latest chapter in the hybrid war against Nicaragua in the second half. But first, Ken Stone and the smoldering desire for peace. Well, welcome back to the show, Ken.
My pleasure, Chris. Anytime.
Well, Ken, now last week marked the beginning of the End the Siege campaign for Syria. What's at issue here?
What's at issue here is getting earthquake relief to the Syrian people who are affected by the massive earthquake. It's been a few weeks, but the problem is that in most of Syria, of the affected areas of Syria, such as Aleppo and Latakia, big cities, no Western earthquake relief is reaching that area and the affected people because of Canadian U.S. sanctions on Syria. So even though the U.S. says that it was lifting sanctions temporarily for 6 months for humanitarian reasons, and Canada says we've never disallowed humanitarian aid to Syria. The fact is, you cannot send aid to Syria unless there are financial transactions involved, and no American, U.S., or European bank will touch a transaction of any magnitude to the areas controlled by the government of Syria. That means that unless it's you go through something like Western Union for $1,000, $2,000 for a personal donation to your own family or somebody you know in Syria, nothing of Western origin, no aid is getting into places like Aleppo and Latakia. Now, aid is getting in to one part of Syria, and that part of Syria is the northeast corner of Syria, which is the Idlib governorate, Idlib province, which is under the control of the Syrian affiliate of Al-Qaeda. So we have this weird and terrible situation where aid goes into the northeast corner of Syria via Turkey, and the Syrian government even allowed a couple of extra openings, entry points, for aid to go into Idlib to help the people who are suffering from the earthquake there. But the aid that goes in is handed over to Al-Qaeda, in other words, terrorists. And these terrorists distribute the aid as they see fit. Of course, they keep most of the aid themselves, as we've seen throughout this long 12-year war in Syria. Whatever aid has gone through in the past to these Al-Qaeda affiliates, they keep most of it for their own fighters, and they often auction off or try and sell it, the rest, to the people. So aid is getting in to Al-Qaeda, but from the West, but not to the people in the government-controlled areas of Syria, such as Latakia and Aleppo. And on top of all that, just yesterday or the day before, the Israeli Air Force attacked. They attacked the runways at Aleppo International Airport, putting them out of commission and thereby preventing relief flights from landing in Aleppo. I call this sadistic because the Israelis know exactly what they're doing, and they're trying, they don't care how many people, ordinary Syrians, suffer from the sanctions, which, by the way, have reduced Syrians to about 2-3 hours of electricity a day. They don't have enough heating oil to heat their homes, and you might have to line up for a day or two to be able to fill up your car at the gas pump. So it's a real, and people are unemployed. The currency has been devalued. This is all because of the U.S. regime change war in Syria, which the Canadian government, since Harper and followed up by Trudeau, have been supporting. And the reason that the Syrians don't have oil is because the eastern third of Syria is currently occupied by the United States of America. They have a number of military bases there, and this happened in about 2017, if I'm not mistaken. And Trump said, yes, we're there to take the oil. We're there to hold on to the oil. It's not U.S. oil. It's not owned by the U.S. And nobody invited the U.S. in. But they're sitting on the oil, and they're plundering it. And they're also plundering the wheat resources of that part of the country, which is the most fertile part of the country. So Syrians in Damascus, Aleppo, and Latakia have no oil, and it's hard to pay for bread, while the U.S. is sitting on the eastern third of Syria. And just this week, U.S. top general Mark Milley paid a visit to one of those illegal U.S. military bases in Syria, and he says that this occupation is going to continue. If you want my opinion of why he did that, I can tell you.
Well, I know that there's been some outrage expressed in Syria. They call his visit illegal. I don't know the legal ins and outs of it. I mean, other than the fact that the American presence in the country is illegal anyway. But yeah, go ahead, Ken.
Well, the U.S. is in the eastern third of Syria. It's occupying it for two reasons. One is to deny the Syrian government, the legitimate government of Syria and Damascus, the revenues from the oil, from the petroleum, and the wheat resources, which would enable Syria to rebuild itself after 12 years of a failed regime change war. That's reason one. Reason two is the U.S. Has said, U.S. officials have been quoted publicly saying that they're sitting on the eastern third of Syria to use it as a bargaining chip in the final settlement over the end of the war in Syria. In other words, the U.S. wants to be able to dictate terms to the Syrian government once the war is over.
Well, I wonder, too, if it doesn't have something to do with Iraq. I said off the top that this is the 20th anniversary of the American invasion. People may be surprised to learn that America still has a military garrison within Syria. It was announced just this past week that garrison would stay in place, much as Milley said that this will stay in place in Syria. He said the same of the 2,000 American soldiers, but don't quote me on the numbers, but they too would stay put in Iraq as well. So I don't know that maybe eastern Syria, which abuts Iraq, might be a part of their the American hope to reinforce its garrison should it need to.
Yes, well, first of all, the U.S. is there. It remains in Syria and Iraq on the pretext of fighting ISIS. And I probably don't have to tell your listeners, but just in case, I will say that ISIS from the very beginning was a U.S. asset. They created it in order to try and overthrow the government of Syria, the government in Damascus, and fracture the country along confessional lines. That failed. But the other purpose ISIS served is that it gives the U.S. a pretext to remain on the lie that the U.S. is fighting terrorism in Syria and Iraq. actually. The U.S., we know very well from statements, from diplomatic cables released by WikiLeaks and statements made by Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, and Joe Biden himself, that the U.S. and its allies, including Saudi Arabia and Israel, financed, trained, supported, armed ISIS, and they have done so for a number of, since about 2014 or 2015. And you'll note that ISIS never attacks U.S. or Israeli installations. It only attacks Syrian installations. And the U.S. and Israel never attack ISIS positions. It's up to the Syrian government, supported by its Iranian and Hezbollah and Russian allies, to do that. So it's been a complete fraud, this whole ISIS operation. And it's been, as I say, a reason for the U.S. to maintain an illegal occupation in Syria, because they haven't been invited, and to maintain its position in Iraq, where they were originally invited. But 3 years ago, after Donald Trump publicly ordered the assassination of General Soleimani and his counterpart in Iraq in a drone strike just outside of Baghdad airport, where Soleimani was on a mission of peace at the invitation of the Iraqi prime minister, and he was to meet with the Saudi Arabian diplomatic representatives. They were trying to arrange a peace. So since just days after that, the Iraqi parliament passed a resolution calling on the U.S. to get out. That resolution was not what they call a binding resolution, but it received unanimous support in the Iraqi parliament, and the U.S. government has just decided to ignore it. So the U.S. government is remaining in Iraq against the clear wishes of the people expressed by the parliament, and they are remaining in Syria as well. So that's why these demonstrations that you started off about are taking place. This is the first time I can ever remember, except for, of course, the embargo on Cuba, that people have taken to the streets in so many countries. Actually, last Saturday, in 13 countries of the world, Canada, the U.S., Germany, Jordan, many other countries, to demonstrate for the end of sanctions on Syria. And the demonstrations were of different sizes in different places, but they are the group that's coordinating this international action is calling for yet another day of international actions on Saturday, March 18th. And there will be one in Canada. It'll be either in Mississauga or in Toronto. There might be one in Montreal as well. So Canadians are taking part in this international movement against sanctions. And it's long overdue, because sanctions are an act of war. And they often kill more people than bullets. If you remember the sanctions on Iraq between the two Gulf Wars that killed 500,000 people, you might recall that Madeleine Albright was interviewed much later. She was the former U.S. Secretary of State who ordered these sanctions. They killed 500,000 children, and on TV she said it was worth it. So these sanctions are a cruel and unjust means of waging war, which only one body in the world can order. And that body is the United Nations Security Council. It's the only body in the world that can order international sanctions, because they're an act of war. And the sanctions on Syria, that were not approved by the UN Security Council, so they are illegal sanctions.
Yeah, well, speaking of illegality now, I'm reading a report from France 24. They quote Agence France-Presse. The transport minister of Syria, Suleiman Khalil, saying of the Aleppo airport attack, he says that since the earthquake a month ago, more than 80 aid flights have landed at Aleppo airport. Aleppo was one of the hardest hit cities by the earthquake, and it was one of the hardest hit cities of the war as well. I can't even imagine there's two bricks standing on top of each other after all of this. On top of that, though, the airport was functional, 80 flights in a month's time. So you're looking at almost three flights a day of aid coming from Iran and other countries that aren't afraid to break the sanctions that the West has ordered. And then the Israeli Air Force attacks, he mentions, does the minister, that this is a double crime. It's a crime to blow up a civilian airport in any instance, but to do so in the condition that things are now in that area, following the earthquake and the long war that Israel has played a very active role in, makes this a crime doubly so.
Well, I have a couple of things to say about that, if you don't mind. The first one is that this is a reckless act by and illegal, as you've already said, by the Israelis, because it might very well provoke a reprisal attack on some Israeli installation or ship or embassy somewhere in the world, and it could cause a spiraling circle of violence. In other words, the reckless Israeli attack endangers all the people in the Middle East, because who knows what could happen as a result of it. And the second thing I want to say about that is crickets. That's what we got in Canada and the U.S. and the Western world. It is crickets in the media, crickets from the governments in the West. Not one of them, to my knowledge, has said anything about the Israeli attack on the Aleppo International Airport. So what they're doing, as usual, is enabling the Israel to carry on its rogue behavior in the world.
Well, and this isn't the first time the Israeli Air Force has been used to bomb Syria. It's been a regular two or three times a week, I think, event that's gone on. And it's funny, when you were talking about ISIS in the now Israeli-occupied Golan Heights, newly occupied during this war against Assad, that there was an instance a few years ago now where Israeli field hospitals were treating wounded. I'm not sure if they were ISIS members or some affiliate of theirs, but it was captured on tape, and there was no denying that they were actually treating the terrorists that they in America were sworn to defeat.
They were transferring wounded al-Nusra fighters from the occupied Golan Heights into Israel to hospitals there, and Prime Minister Netanyahu visited them publicly, and it was on TV and in all the newspapers that Syria was helping al-Nusra fight the government in Damascus. They would Israel. Yeah, Israel's fighting. Israel is helping. Israel would prefer, they said, to have al-Nusra in Damascus than President Assad.
Yeah, well, that must have been a moment of great embarrassment for the Americans. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Ken Stone. Ken's an executive member of both the Syria Support Movement International and Hamilton Coalition to Stop the Wars. We're talking a little bit about Syria first. And Ken, you said a couple of things, Ken, that I want to clarify. If I, for example, am Syrian living in Canada, is it still possible for me to send money via Western Union or another means to my relatives there without falling afoul of Canada's sanction regime against the country?
As I understand it, in the U.S., Western Union has been allowing transfers of up to $2,000 a day from individuals in the U.S. to individuals in Syria. And the last thing I heard was that Syrians in Canada were trying to see if Western Union would do it here. And so far, no luck. People are using informal networks to get aid to Syria. For example, the Syrian community in Mississauga collected tents and sleeping bags, a whole warehouse full of them. They packaged them up. They sent them by the Jordanian Airlines, took it for free, I think, and took it to Jordan, and then they brought it across the border into Syria. And other people I know in Canada are using friends in Lebanon or groups in Lebanon to funnel financial contributions into Syria. I don't have the the information at my fingertips for you right now. But if anybody is interested in finding out a way to send money to Syria from Canada, they can write to the coalition at HCSW, Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, HCSW at Cogeco.ca.
How do you spell Cogeco, Ken?
Cogeco.ca.
Yeah, well, I guess what I was wondering is if they're running a risk of having their bank accounts seized by the Canadian government, people that do, as you describe.
I don't think that's a risk. What the problem is, the real problem that the Syrian Canadian community is concerned about, is the fact that the Canadian government broke off diplomatic relations with Syria, and they closed the Syrian embassy in Ottawa, which means that Syrians have no access to their birth certificates, their driver's license, their educational certificates. They can't get a transcript. They can't communicate with any government departments in Syria. So they're isolated from their families, and it causes them a lot of stress and grief. And one of the things they keep demanding at these demonstrations is for Canada to reopen the Syrian embassy in Ottawa.
Well, Ken, in the United States, I'm just reading Aaron Maté is on Twitter talking about a motion in the Congress down there to lift the sanctions, and it was defeated. And he says that after the earthquake, every single House Democrat, including the squad, the so-called progressive wing, voted to reject the lifting of U.S. sanctions on Syria, even while the top UN expert, humanitarian expert, says that these are these sanctions, and this is in a report from November of last year, say that these are absolutely suffocating sanctions and they are crimes against humanity, essentially.
That was Elena Doohan, D-O-U-H-A-N, and she wrote a magnificent report, which has been ignored in the West.
The media now, you, Ken, you wrote, you did something that I stopped doing a very long time ago, and that was listened to The Current, the radio program on the CBC. And if only our listeners could see hear your eyes roll as I can. But you talked, you wrote a letter to Matt Galloway, the host of that program, in talking about his interview with Dr. Al Qassim, who was delivering aid to Syria. Do you want to go over that?
Yes, it's a particularly obnoxious example of Canadian hypocrisy. Dr. Al Qassim is a doctor in the Hamilton and Oakville area, and he works for the Canadian government, or he gets money for his organization, which is whose acronym, his initials are UOSSM. I forget what it stands for, but you can Google it. And what it is a medical organization that works exclusively and has worked only exclusively in areas controlled by the terrorists in Syria since 2014. So what Dr. Al-Qassam does is he collects medical supplies and money and resources from the Canadian government, gets them into Turkey and takes them across the border into Idlib. In 2016, Dr. Al-Qassam was in Aleppo while half of Aleppo was occupied by the terrorists. And when there was while the liberation of Aleppo was going on, Dr. Al-Qassam came here to Hamilton, Ontario, to participate in a protest organized by Syrian opposition people here at Hamilton City Hall. We went there and we handed out flyers and talked to people and tried to show them what was really going on. And he was saying that there was a bloodbath going on in Aleppo and that the Syrian government was killing everybody in sight in East Aleppo. It was all a lie. And the people that they had demonstrating were Syrian refugee children. They went through the Syrian community here in Hamilton. They picked up about 80 children. They dressed them all up in white sheets with bloody handprints on them. Well, they weren't real blood, but they were red paint handprints. And that was their demonstration against the liberation of Aleppo. And he is the guy who Matt Galloway interviewed. And what I asked Matt Galloway to do was to interview me or somebody else in the Syrian community or somebody in the peace movement to give the other side of the story, saying that why sanctions have to be lifted on Syria, as explained by Dr. Alina Duhan, the UN official rapporteur on coercive economic measures, specifically on Syria, because, as you said, they are suffocating the people, they are starving the people, and I imagine that they're killing the people too, because they're not getting medical resources. When they do operations in Syrian hospitals, they have to use their personal cell phones for lighting, because there's no electricity. I mean, how bad does it have to get before the Canadian government shows a little bit of humanity?
Well, I can't say that I'm stunned. I'm not surprised, but maybe I'm numbed by the way Canadians, their lack of imagination in trying to assess what's going on in other places in the world that have been bombed back to the Stone Age, or at least the pre-electricity age, and how they can't seem to understand what it's like when the power goes out here. Just imagine what it's like for you when you lose power in a winter storm or whatnot for a couple of few hours. What you saw, can you imagine having that every day, and not to mention all the emergency services and so forth? You say in your open letter to Matt Galloway, and I'll quote you, if you would like to offer your listeners a broader picture of the deadly effects of the earthquake in Syria, which are compounded by Canada's illegal sanctions on that country, I'd be pleased to sit for an interview with you. Did Matt respond?
In one word? No.
Well, that wasn't the word I thought you were going to say, so I don't have to use my bleep machine. Yeah, well, I guess it's a rhetorical question, but the way that the media generally has been in this country. But Ken, we're out of time for this segment. I'm going to be talking with Dan Kovalik about Nicaragua and another place that Canada has onerous sanctions. Are the sanctions Canada has against Nicaragua, do you know, Ken, illegal as well? Or have they been sanctified by the United Nations?
They have not been sanctified by the United Nations. They are illegal. Nicaragua is among, last count, 21 countries that are being sanctioned by Canada in the world. And most of them are countries, poor countries in the global south. And about a third of those countries are countries in Africa, in where mostly people of color live, and they live in a very poor condition. So we are basically kicking the marginalized people of the world while they're down. That's what Canada is doing with these sanctions.
Well, the rule of law, and as ever, the law is meant to restrain the poor, not the rich. We'll break off then, and I'll come back with Dan Kovalik. But Ken and I are going to do an extended version of this that you can find at the website guerrilla-radio.com. Thanks, Ken.
My pleasure.
Well, I gotta think that we're not alone.
I'm sitting in my house watching all this happen, and I've arrived to a point where I just can't keep my mouth shut anymore.
Guerrilla Radio, you're not alone. And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, far from fulfilling its mandate to first be an agent opposing war in the world, the United Nations' repeated failure in that seminal mission are now manifest in its endeavoring the opposite, the promotion of economic sanctions and military intervention. At least the recently released group of experts on human rights on Nicaragua report leaves little else to conclude. Dan Kovalik is a lawyer, educator, labor, peace and justice activist, democracy defender, journalist, author, and filmmaker. His book titles include Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture, the Plot 2 series on American efforts to undermine the government and economies of Iran, Venezuela, Russia, and let's face it, the world generally, and No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interests. His latest is the recently released Nicaragua, A History of U.S. Intervention and Resistance, which, quote, explores the pernicious nature of U.S. engagement with Nicaragua from the mid-19th century to the present in pursuit of control and domination rather than in defense of democracy. Welcome back to the program, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, it's always my pleasure, of course. Now, Dan, first of all, congratulations on the release of Nicaragua, A History of U.S. Intervention and Resistance.
Thank